Hello, I'm Sebastian. Welcome to Nine Nartrees podcast. Today, I will summarize and review the book. Edward W. Said Orientalism is a landmark work of cultural criticism that examines how Western scholarship, literature, art, and politics have portrayed what they call the Orient, broadly meaning North Africa, the Middle East, and parts of Asia. Said argues that these portrayals are not neutral descriptions, but a powerful set of ideas that helped Europe and later the United States justify influence, rule, and intervention. Blending literary analysis, intellectual history, and political critique, the book traces how academic expertise, travel writing, and imaginative works shaped a recurring image of Eastern societies as timeless, exotic, irrational, and in need of Western guidance. Said also shows how institutions such as universities, museums, and colonial administrations reinforce these frameworks, turning representations into policy habits and common sense. Often credited with helping define post-colonial studies, Orientalism remains widely read because it challenges readers to reconsider how knowledge is produced, whose voices are amplified, and how cultural narratives can shape real-world power relations. I will give you key takeaways from this book. Firstly, Orientalism as a system of knowledge and power. A central topic is Said approach to Orientalism, not as a simple collection of stereotypes, but as an organized way of producing knowledge that is closely tied to power. He treats Western writing about the East as an interconnected field of ideas that establishes what can be said, taught, and believed about Eastern peoples and places. In this view, authority comes from institutions and from repetition scholars, cite earlier scholars, writers echo familiar tropes, and public discourse absorbs these patterns until they feel natural. Said emphasizes that these patterns matter because they shape decisions beyond classrooms and libraries. When a region is framed as backward, irrational, or permanently different, political domination can be made to look like reform or stewardship. This topic also highlights how expertise can become a form of control. The more the West claims to know the Orient, the easier it becomes to speak for it and over it. Said does not deny cultural differences, but he challenges the assumption that the West has a privileged, objective vantage point. Instead, he urges readers to examine how descriptions are produced, what interests they serve, and how a supposedly academic tradition can support unequal relations in the world. Secondly, representation and the making of the other, another major theme, is how representation constructs an other, a simplified figure of the Orient that contrasts with an idealized image of the West. Said analyzes how Western narratives often define Eastern societies through a narrow set of recurring attributes such as sensuality, despotism, passivity, mysticism, or violence. These traits are presented as inherent and unchanging, which turns complex historical communities into a static backdrop for Western self-definition. The West appears rational, modern, moral, and dynamic, precisely because the Orient is depicted as its opposite. This topic is especially important because it shows that representation is not a harmless cultural habit. When large populations are portrayed as incapable of self-government or as driven by impulse rather than reason, those images can legitimize intervention and dismissal of local perspectives. Said also emphasizes that representation tends to erase internal diversity and debate within Eastern societies. Differences of class, language, politics, and history are flattened into a single unit that can be named and managed. Readers come away with a toolkit for noticing how language, imagery, and narrative structure can set the terms of reality, directing attention towards certain features while rendering others invisible. Thirdly, from scholarly discourse to empire and administration, Said devotes significant attention to the relationship between intellectual work and imperial governance. This topic explores how Orientalist scholarship did not merely accompany colonial expansion, but often provided categories and assumptions that made colonial rule seem coherent and necessary. Administrative practices relied on frameworks that classified people and traditions, translated legal and religious systems into Western terms, and ranked cultures in developmental hierarchies. Even when individual scholars claimed to be detached observers, their work could circulate within networks that included diplomats, military planners, and colonial officials. The book encourages readers to see the traffic between texts and institutions. A study of language, history, or religion may influence what officials think is possible, what they fear, and what they consider legitimate. Said also traces how the authority of scholarly discourse can outlast formal empires. Once embedded in educational curricula, media conventions, and policy assumptions, the old colonial gaze can persist in new forms, including strategic studies and modern commentary on the region. This theme helps explain why debates about foreign policy often replay older stories about civilizational difference. It challenges readers to ask how knowledge is mobilized, who funds it, and what consequences follow when cultural description becomes a tool of rule. Fourthly, literature, art, and the imaginative geography of East and West. A distinctive contribution of Orientalism is its attention to imaginative works and to what Tsai calls an imaginative geography, the mental map that divides the world into a familiar West and a distant, noble Orient. This topic shows how novels, travel writing, painting, and other arts helped fix the East as a stage for Western adventure, desire, or moral testing. Even when the setting is richly described, the depiction often serves Western concerns more than it reflects local realities. The Orient becomes a place where fantasy is licensed and where complexity can be reduced to atmosphere. It prepares audiences to accept certain narratives as plausible, such as the idea that Eastern societies are timeless or that Western presence is a catalyst for progress. The power of these works lies in their emotional and aesthetic appeal, which can make their assumptions harder to notice. This theme also highlights how cultural authority is built. Canonical works become reference points that later writers and readers treat as evidence. By studying aesthetic representation alongside academic and political writing, Tsai offers readers a way to connect cultural taste with historical power, showing how art can participate in world-making. Lastly, critique, method, and the stakes for post-colonial thought. The final key topic concerns the critical method and the broader stakes of Tsai's argument for fields like history, literature, anthropology, and area studies. Tsai encourages a self-reflective approach that asks how researchers position themselves, what assumptions they inherit, and how their language frames the people they study. He is skeptical of claims to pure objectivity when scholars work within unequal global contexts, yet he does not argue that cross-cultural study is impossible. Instead, he pushes for more responsible forms of engagement that recognize agency, historical change, and the right of people to represent themselves. This topic also covers the book Impact It Helped Energize Postcolonial Scholarship by connecting cultural analysis to political structures, and it sparks strong debate about fairness, evidence, and generalization. Whether readers agree with all of Tsai's conclusions, the methodological challenge remains influential. The book asks academics and general readers to examine the ethical dimension of interpretation, especially when studying societies that have been subjected to conquest or intervention. It also raises practical questions about how media and education can move beyond inherited frames. In this sense, the stakes are not only intellectual but civic. How we describe others can shape what we think we are allowed to do to them. In conclusion, this book is best suited for readers interested in history, literature, politics, media, international relations, and anyone trying to understand how cultural narratives influence public opinion and policy. Students entering postcolonial studies or Middle East and North Africa studies will find it foundational, while general readers will gain a sharper lens for evaluating headlines, films, museum stories, and travel narratives. The main life benefit is intellectual clarity. Tsai gives readers a disciplined way to question seemingly neutral descriptions and to notice how authority is built through repetition, institutions, and inherited categories. That skill transfers directly to everyday media consumption and to professional settings where cultural assumptions shape decisions. Compared with many books that treat stereotypes as individual prejudice, Orientalism explains the deeper architecture of representation, connecting cultural images to systems of knowledge and governance. And its interdisciplinary method also distinguishes it from narrower studies that focus only on colonial administration or only on literature. Even when readers disagree with elements of Tsai's thesis, the book rewards careful engagement because it forces a more rigorous standard for how we speak about other societies. For those seeking a classic that continues to animate debate across the humanities and social sciences, it remains worth buying and rereading. If you would like to support Edward W. Tsai, you can buy the book through the Amazon link I've provided in the podcast description. After reading the book, please let me know what you think and share your thoughts. See you around.